you. You can be me. And I'll drink all the time, 'cause we're lovers, that is the fact. Yes, we're lovers, that is the fact. Oh, nothing will keep us together. Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon where in the world you are and what time of the day you're listening to this episode of Talking the Blues. Andy and George, hello to you both.
Hi, Paul.
Hi. I think probably there's so much news to cover this week, but I think first and foremost, and probably still on the minds of almost all Evertonians and certainly many other football fans, probably around the world actually, is the very sad passing of Kevin Campbell. So I think we should probably start there. I mean, what can you say about the man?
Too sudden too. I saw him only 10 days ago on some chat show and he was full of life.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very sad. It is in the public domain that he had kidney issues. And sadly, his demise was very, very quick. I suppose I shouldn't have been ready, but I was just completely overwhelmed by the response of people on social media, and then more generally the response of people in and around football. And let's talk about him from the point of view of him as a person in the first instance. And obviously, I suppose we should say in the first instance as well, our thoughts and prayers go out to his family and to his friends and anybody that was associated with him. If our grief is palpable, goodness knows what your grief is, because you would be the people closest to him, and you would be the people who loved him and experienced him day in, day out, and to have him taken away from you so suddenly, so quickly, and as George said, at such a young age, must be an impossible situation. So whilst obviously we do remember Kevin, I think first and foremost it's his family and friends that we must consider, and everybody has been very respectful so far, and we will be equally so, but obviously we can't go into this podcast ignoring what's happened. So as a person, I don't recall ever seeing anybody that didn't have anything but the highest and the most fulsome praise for the guy, and everybody that met him has a funny story to tell.
I think that's what's come through on social media and on the TV. Obviously, we've got the Euros on, so he's been mentioned a few times in the preamble before the games and what have you. He appears to be, most footballers are popular, but some more popular than others. He seems to have been universally popular. Obviously
really
respected by Arsenal
why,
fans.
Sorry, mate. Go on.
Obviously respected by Arsenal fans, Evertonians. I had a message actually from someone who's well connected at West Brom to say that the whole of the West Brom community were devastated when they'd heard the news, and he was only with them a short time, but he thoroughly enjoyed his time as a West Brom player. And he just seems to have made that mark with every club he played for. He's been, universally popular, because the big thing about him, you know, the one thing I remember about him as a player is he never, ever gave anything less than his best effort. And that's all we ever ask for as supporters, that players, you know, play with their heart on their sleeve and give of their best effort. And, you know, fans are always critical of players for various parts of their game. I don't think anybody's ever... I've never heard anybody criticise Kevin Campbell other than being a full-blooded, wholesome, give-everything-for-the-team whose shirt he was wearing kind of guy. And obviously what he did for Everton in his time as a Blue puts him right up with... He does actually put him right up there with some of the greats who've worn... Or not some of the greats, with the other greats who've worn the blue shirt. And he'll for that, you know, he should be remembered and revered and never forgotten.
Yeah, well said, Andy. George, what were your thoughts?
Nothing to add to that. Whatsoever. That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why he connected to everybody. Because, as Andy said, that's all the thing that connects us to every Partick Thistle, Dumbarton, Stockport County fan is respect for people who give everything. Because it is all you ask. And it's really annoying when players don't. Because you think, my God, you're being rewarded for this. He never played for the reward. He played for the joy of the game. And you could touch it and feel it and see it in him. And that's why everybody really liked him and respected him, and that's why everybody's been so grief-stricken.
Yeah, I think he lived his life that way, didn't he, George? He lived his life not necessarily for the reward that life brings you, but just for the sheer joy.
It looked like it, didn't it? It looked like it, yeah.
I mean, just... I remember the last time I saw him was the Bournemouth game at the end of, not last season, the season before last. And he was walking on Goodison Road, and it must have been about, probably about an hour and a half before kickoff. And it was really crowded for that time. I think it was because obviously, you know, it was such an important game. And if you recall, it was a beautiful afternoon, a bit windy, mm-hmm. but a beautiful afternoon. And I was standing outside the Winslow with a few other people, and like this guy appeared, this is Kevin Campbell, and there was just like a parting of the waves. It was a bit like Moses going through the Red Sea, except this was a blue sea. And then everybody just started singing his name, and I will never ever forget the smile on his face. When everybody started singing his name, it was just sheer joy from him, and just sheer love and adoration from everybody that was around him. And talking to the people I was with, they said it's like that every week. Because I don't get to the game so often these days, and I was like, wow, it's completely blown away by it. And they're like, no, it's like that every week, every time he always goes for a pint. And it's exactly the same. It's just incredible. Amazing.
Good story.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple of interesting things about him. So in his first full season in Arsenal's youth team, he scored 59 goals.
Oh, my God.
And a starter for 10, okay, University Challenge, no conferring. Who did he make his senior team debut against in, I think it was March 1988?
Go on, Everton.
Everton, yeah. Yeah, playing for Arsenal.
Did he score?
They're the bonus questions, Andy.
All right.
And, no, I didn't look up the score. I just I remember reading it somewhere, and I just checked it to make sure it was correct. And yeah, his first senior game was in 1988, and it was against Everton. It would obviously still be at Highbury, and I'm just trying to think what the score would have been. No, can't.
Don't anyway, worry about
it. Yeah. And then, of course,
I didn't look one up, Paul.
And then, of course, it was 11 years later that he turned up at Goodison, and what an impact he had at Goodison. I don't know if you heard it, there's a lovely story. Well, actually, there's so many lovely stories, but he came to Everton from his time in Turkey.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of really funny stories. The first one is when he joined, it was Trabzonspor, wasn't it, that he joined?
Yeah.
And this wasn't even like a game. It was just an open training session at their old stadium, not the modern stadium that they're in now, but like the old stadium that they're in. And the story goes that like 30,000 people, capacity crowd, turned up just to watch them train, and they were all in the ground an hour and a half before the training was due to start. And Campbell's like meeting his teammates in the changing room, such as it was. And then they had to line up in this corridor that sort of ran sideways to the pitch, so you couldn't actually see the pitch. And he's at the back because obviously they wanted to bring him out last, given that he was like the big signing and everything else. And he said he's standing there and he's like, his teammates are going ahead of him. And as it's getting towards his time, to enter the pitch, this really old Turkish guy appears, like with a big thick rope, and he's tugging like mad on this rope, and the rope goes round a corner because there's a bit of a kink in the tunnel. Anyway, cut a long story short, he keeps pulling on this rope, and next minute this bloody goat appears at the other end of the rope. And pardon my language, but Kevin Campbell says this goat's shitting everywhere, all over the corridor. Anyway, this old Turkish guy, he's got, in one hand he's got this rope and he's dragging this goat onto the pitch. In the other hand, he's got like this like 40-inch blade, a metal blade, a knife.
Yeah.
And Campbell follows him onto the pitch, and everybody like going nuts and everything else. And this guy's standing there with this poor goat, and he flicks the goat over onto its back and slits the goat's throat.
Right.
And apparently it was a tradition, and somebody came up to Campbell and said, right, what you've got to do is you've got to like dip your finger. So I'm sorry if this is gruesome and anybody's having their dinner or anything when they're listening to this, but you've got to dip your finger into where the goat's throat had been cut, cover it with blood, put a little mark on your forehead, but you've also got to put a blood mark on your boots. And this is apparently a tradition that's like gone on for years and years and years. And in the story, Campbell says that the thing he was most worried about was the fact that he was wearing white Puma boots and that the blood was going to ruin his boots. Anyway, he does it. And then by this time the goat's dead. They take the goat off, and while the training session's on, they cook the goat. And like they hand the goat out to like all the poor people around the stadium, and it apparently was a tradition. Whether it's still a tradition today or not, I don't know. But that was his introduction, and obviously when he was there, it sort of didn't always go great for him. I think he had some issues with racism whilst he was there, and once he got the call that Everton were interested in him from his agent, I think there was seven or eight clubs that were interested in him. He said, yeah, absolutely, Everton, big club. So he flew into London, and then he got a flight from London to Manchester, where he was being picked up by Walter Smith. And so he's sitting on whatever, a BA flight from Heathrow to Manchester. And he's sitting there, and he's like sitting next to a guy who turns out to be an Evertonian. And Campbell sort of decides he's going to have a bit of fun with this guy, so he doesn't say who he is. And he gets chatting to the guy, you know, like, who do you support? Are you a blue or a red? And he hears this guy's got a Liverpool accent, and he sort of decides to have a bit of fun with him. So he says, are you a blue or a red? And this guy says, well, I'm a blue. Campbell goes, oh, that's great. How are they doing? So he spends about 40 minutes, this guy, telling him how terrible Everton were at the time, and, you know, how we were really struggling, and we were, I think at the time, 15th in the league, and, you know, Walter Smith was not very popular, nice man, nice manager and everything else, but not very popular with the crowd, and, you know, there's a real prospect of relegation and anything else. Anyway, Campbell says absolutely nothing, but he sort of drops a bit of a hint to the guy, and he says, I'm maybe taking a job in Liverpool. And in fact, actually, funny enough, I'm meeting a guy called Smith when I get up there. And this guy doesn't twig at all. You know, he's got no idea who Kevin Campbell, clearly he's got no idea who Kevin Campbell is, let alone that he might be joining Everton. So they get off the plane at Manchester and they walk through, arrivals together. And apparently they swapped telephone numbers, and Campbell said, like, you know, let's keep in touch. I really enjoyed the conversation and everything else. So they walk out of arrivals at Manchester, and there's Walter Smith waiting for Kevin Campbell. Mm-hmm. And Campbell goes, you know, this guy's face when he realised A, it was Walter Smith, and B, who Kevin Campbell was an absolute picture. Anyway, they all had a bit of a laugh and everything else, and the guy says, it was great fun, blah, blah. And Kevin says, I'll keep in touch with you. Don't worry, I'll keep in touch with you. And he did. And the last game of the season, you know, the last game at Goodison when we won 6-0 against West Ham, when Campbell scored a hat-trick, he invited him to the game, and the guy that he sat next to on the plane was his guest of honour for the day.
That's nice.
Top story,
And I'm sure like there's hundreds of other similar stories, but they were just two that I picked up on. Just thought it would be, I would imagine Walter Smith would have seen the funny side of that as well.
Yeah.
So we scored. We're going to get onto other stuff in a couple of minutes, but he scored. It was 9 goals in the last 8 games, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I'm gonna test your memories to see if you can remember who you scored against.
Correct.
You're on here, Andy.
Charlton Athletic.
Yep, we won 4-1.
Yeah. Flipping heck.
Mm-hmm. I bet you were at every game, Andy.
I don't think I was actually our kid.
But, we were in deep trouble because we lost four games on the run. We lost Liverpool, Sheffield, Arsenal, United, Liverpool, and Sheffield United. We lost those four games, and then we went into the Coventry game, and we were in 16th position, and we were, you know, really struggling. And he scored two goals in that, which we won 2-0.
Coventry was away, wasn't it?
No, that was at home.
Oh, that was at Goodison.
Yeah, the Newcastle game, which was the following
Newcastle
game.
Newcastle, yeah.
Was away when we won 3-1. And yeah. Scott Gemmell scored the other one.
Yeah, who signed with him.
Yeah, that's right, he did. And then Charlton was the 4-1 game.
Right.
When he scored 2 goals again. So he scored 6 in 3. He didn't score against Chelsea when we lost. And then he scored a hat-trick, if you remember, which was the final home game of the season against West Ham when we won 6-0.
Mm.
And by that time, we were 14th and safe.
That's hell of an impact.
Yeah. But I suppose he'll always be remembered when he for scoring at Anfield.
Anfield, yeah. Everybody who scores at Anfield gets remembered.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, but we needed that. We needed that one big time.
Yeah, we did. And of course, that was the last time we won at Anfield, apart from the COVID game. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Anyway, I suppose lots of Blues could talk for hours about him, and lots of Blues will, and it's very sad. But anyway, that's our little memory of him, and love and prayers to everybody that's close
to his family.
And indeed, of course, other Evertonians, because clearly on
it's a
social
family, isn't it?
Yeah, and he obviously meant a great deal to a huge number of people, and you know there will be people who had much greater exposure to him than any of the three of us did, who will be feeling it even more so. So
yeah, absolutely. While we're at it, I mean, we've already said that. You know, taken too young. I think we should also mention the sad death of the Millwall goalie at 26.
Oh yeah,
yeah. I wasn't aware of the. I was aware that he passed away, but I didn't know the circumstances behind.
Yeah, no, I don't. I've not looked at any detail, but it was. You know, that was reported yesterday as well.
Yeah,
26 years of age. That's you know, that's horrendous. You know, so thoughts to his family as well.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Gosh. Okay. Well, let's try and lift the mood a little bit. It seems that we've got new owners.
Tell us all about it.
Yeah.
That
came out of the blue a little bit, didn't it? Because it came, the name appeared only kind of early last week, didn't it? Looks like they're now, obviously, that's the preferred bid. Is this the third preferred bid?
Well,
under
I have to say, last week was probably one of the craziest week for anybody that was involved in Everton and anybody that was involved in the takeover activity. I've been involved in quite a few takeovers over the years, and you know, I think most people understand that I had some involvement in this one. I've never witnessed anything like it. I've never witnessed such changes in direction. One minute thinking that it was going the way that perhaps you wanted it to go because you were involved in another bid, and then somebody else perhaps, first of all, being mentioned in the media and then being mentioned by Fahd Mashiri's people. It was just absolutely crazy. And I think we all forget sometimes, actually, how hard some people have to work on transactions like this. I know, like, there are millions of people that work hard doing whatever job that they do. But literally for the last 10, 15 days, perhaps, there have been people working on this sort of like 20 hours a day. You know, lawyers, bankers, financiers, all sorts of different people. And not all of them got the outcome that they wanted, obviously, because some people were working on stuff that didn't end up happening. But yeah, it was just remarkable. I know on two occasions, one particular party was told, as I say, on two separate occasions by Fahd Mashiri that they had got the deal and that they should prepare whatever it was that they had to prepare in order to see the deal through, then only to find out on the Friday that, in fact, Mashiri had changed his mind. And Mashiri changed his mind because we'll get into a bit more of the detail of the Friedkin deal in a minute. Mashiri ultimately changed his mind because the Friedkin deal offered Mashiri better terms than the other deals had offered.
That was always like to be the case that he was going to hang on to the last minute to try and extract a better offer from somebody, wasn't it?
Yeah,
understandably. I mean, I'm not being critical of him for that. You know. He wants to recover as much as he can, and so he's hung on as long as he can. The only trouble is that the amount of time it's taken it's eating into the close season, and it puts whoever takes over, whether it's the Friedkin group or whoever, it gives them less and less time to begin the work of repair before we have to start a new season. And I just think, you know, I understand where Michiel is coming from, that he wants as much of his investment back as he can. But has he done that purely in his own interest? Because it doesn't strike me as being in the best interest of Everton Football Club. Because, like I said, to be, well, it's put us further behind the eight ball than when we were already behind.
Yeah, you know, I can go back to September. I can go back before September, and I could literally, and probably did on one or two occasions, argue that what Mashiri was doing was massively unprofessional, didn't put the club's interests to the fore, put his own interests to the fore, his judgments in terms of the people that he chose. And this is probably the last time we ever need to talk about 777 on this podcast. Hopefully it is. You know, the choice of 777 and the idea that, I mean, when one looks back at it and you listen to his words on the 15th of September last year, it's just it's absolutely crazy. The fact that he thought that they were the best people to take over Everton Football Club. And you know, it's interesting because there's obviously, people will be aware, there's several court cases going through the US at the moment. And whilst I'm not going to comment on the actual cases themselves, some of the evidence that's been presented in those cases and is in the public domain, because the judges allowed them to be so, some of that evidence Fahad Mashiri and Fahad Mashiri's people would have seen when they did any due diligence that they did do.
If?
Well, then if they didn't do any due diligence, how could he possibly claim they were the best people?
Well, exactly. But I mean, you've just said then, Paul, that he made those statements about 777 being, in his opinion, the best option for Everton Football Club back on September the 15th, did you say?
Yeah.
And here we are now on, correct me if I'm wrong, it's the 16th of June. And we're now into a third or a fourth party, because if you count 777 and then ACAP, and then we assume that the bid from Andy Bell and George Downing, and now we're with the Friedkin. So that's the fourth one that we are absolutely certain of. And if that's going to take a further 4 to 6 weeks for that to be ratified and for it to be, you know, all I's dotted and T's crossed.
We'll have sold the first team squad by then.
Well, we're going to be in August. So what should have taken 10 or 12 weeks originally has taken the thick end of 11 months. And that cannot be good for the short-term future of Everton Football Club. And that's why I'm saying that, you know, the club are already behind the eight ball. We've got a new owner to be ratified and come in and start the repair work. I mean, it's going to be hell of a first 100 days for them taking over. They talk about the first 100 days of a new government. Imagine the pressure on the first 100 days on the new ownership. And it's because of prevarication from Fahad Mashiri.
Absolutely.
In my opinion.
Give a shite, Andy. He is running for the hills with his carpet bags bulging with the best he could manage. He'll never look back and he'll never think about it again.
Well, maybe not, but there's probably 500,000 Blues around the world who will be thinking about it.
Absolutely, Andy. Absolutely. Well, we're going to carry the can down the road for quite some time, I would imagine.
And that's what I say, that the new ownership, whoever it might be, has got, you know, has, well, they've got the work cut out. They really have. And it's, you know, all the nonsense of preferred bids and best interest, you know, the best going forward, dear me. Talk about wacko decisions. I mean, Paul, to be fair, you know, you've banged that drum from day one on 777 and subsequently on ACAP and what have you. It's just a nonsense.
I'm tempted to ask the question that I think most Blues will be wanting to know about is, does this takeover in any way protect us from having to sell the people we don't want to sell?
I'll get on to that in a second, George. I just want to make one point about what happened in September last year when Mashiri decided that 777 were to be the, you know, his choice of owners. Just prior to the 15th of September, a young lady, I shouldn't really call it, a professional woman, a lawyer who worked for Pinsent Mason, lost her life. And it's not known whether she intended to lose her life or not, but she fell in front of a train in London and she left her family behind with young children. And it was recognised that at the time she was drinking too much. She'd already been to seek medical attention on it. And it was a result of the intense pressure that she was under, working for Pinsent Mason, who are Everton's lawyer. And she was working on that deal, which included 777 and was never subsequently, obviously, the right deal, nor was it ever executed, thankfully. But, you know, we talk about, you know, the cost of all of these things. That lady and her family paid the ultimate price for Mashiri's misjudgment in bringing 777 in. And they may sound extraordinarily harsh words, but I think it is the case. And I've said it. And when all of this is done, then that family, her family, and her young children will still be without their mother, and I don't think that should ever be forgotten. Mm. I'm sure it was never Mashiri's intention for something like that to happen, but nevertheless, as a result of the intense work pressures that 777 and Everton created for that lady, that's what happened. And, well, anyway, I've said that. So to answer your question, George, I don't think it changes much,
right,
for a number of reasons. One is the timing, because 4 to 6 weeks is my estimation of how long this will take. Not, you know, the club hasn't said anything, because actually, you know, formally the takeover hasn't started yet. Mashiri said who is preferred buyer is now, which is the Friedkin group, Dan Friedkin in particular. Whilst they've indicated that they want to go ahead with it, they haven't formally said that they're going ahead with it. They will do either tomorrow, which is Monday, if you're listening to this on the Sunday, or on Tuesday. And one of the things that they have to do in the first instance, in order to get into the exclusivity point, which is where then it becomes sort of real, is provide the funds to pay off MSP, which is about 158, maybe 160 million, and right, also provide some additional funding for the club, because the club has a big item of expenditure in about 5 or 6 days' time, of around about £40 million, and that relates to the stadium.
Right.
And you know, one of the, one of the, or two of the conditions of going forwards with this for the Friedkin Group are to make that payment to MSP and to make that payment so that the club satisfies its obligations to Langaroa. Now, I've got absolutely no doubt that they will go ahead and do that. You know, they have the resources to do it. From what I learnt on Friday afternoon, that they're committed to this, and you know they want to do it. So I am expecting them to either do it tomorrow or on Tuesday at the very latest, and then the exclusivity will be announced, and we then go through the process that took 9 months with 777, but will take considerably shorter period of time with the Friedkin Group. And why will it take a shorter period of time? Well, because it's very easy to establish, first of all, that they've got the money. Secondly, that they will meet all of the other requirements of the fit and proper persons test, or the directors and owners test, as it's more properly known. And that they can fund whatever the club needs going forwards. But specifically to answer your question, George, and we did ask for questions earlier on Twitter. And I'm not going to mention everybody's name because there were over 30 questions, but quite a few people asked, what does it mean for the transfer window? Now, depending upon when this deal actually concludes and when actually they own 94% of Everton Football Club, if that's done before the end of the transfer window, then things might change at the end of the transfer window. But between now and then, it's going to be pretty much as we thought it would be had there not been a change of ownership. And there may be slightly less pressure to sell, but it still means that we're going to sell.
Right.
I think that's good. Onana is definitely going. And despite having heard during the week from a pretty well-respected agent that Branthwaite was prepared to stay at Everton and do another year at Everton, I'm pretty certain in my own mind, at least, that you know he's going to move to another Premier League club.
Given the length of time that this sale of the club by Moshiri Stoke, takeover of the club by whoever, has dragged on, is there no way that the club can ask the Premier League or put a case forward to the Premier League that, you know, because of how long it's dragged on since September last year, for an accommodation with regards to what may be coming down the track in terms of having to sell players to satisfy profit and sustainability rules again? It's not the club's fault. It's the club's fault that they've fallen into issues with profit and sustainability, but it's not the club's fault per se that this takeover and sale has dragged on so long. So is there no chance that the Premier League could be asked for, as I say, an accommodation, which would take the pressure off, hopefully, having to sell, and having to sell arguably our most valuable asset, or assets if it would be, to be more than one player?
I think it's a really interesting question, Andy, and it's a question that should be asked of the Premier League. I think the counter argument to that is, well, you could have sold the club to the right people at any time in the last 9 or 12 months, and you chose not to. Not the club, obviously the owner, but the responsibility falls back on the club, unfortunately. So I think it'd be 50-50. Interestingly,
let me come in then. At the same time that this has been dragging on, do we know if the Premier League have ever spoke to Moshiri to say, listen, pal, the longer you drag this out, the more problems your club is going to run into?
You'd like to think that there's a relationship, maybe not between Moshiri and the Premier League, but say between Everton's interim CEO Colin Chong and his counterpart, he might be Richard Masters, it might be somebody else within the Premier League, who says, you know, really you should get this sorted out, or, you know, what's the situation? I can't believe that they've like just operated in complete isolation of each other in the last 9 months, you know, whilst this supposed takeover by 777 has trundled along. I just don't believe that for a second. So right. You'd hope that those types of sensible conversations have already taken place. If they haven't, and one of the interesting aspects about when Dan Friedkin took over, Roma, was that Roma were in really deep trouble with, we're in really deep trouble with UEFA over UEFA's financial fair play rules. And they got a partial dispensation when they took over. So it wasn't complete, but it was partial. And it gave them a little bit more breathing room than they had when before they came in. Because if you remember, Roma was owned by a guy called another American hedge fund investor, a guy called James Pallotta, and he made such a mess of that football. I mean, there are some similarities actually between both clubs. They were in a real financial mess. They hadn't got as far as didn't get anywhere near as far as we got, you know, with the stadium project. They've been trying to build a new stadium, and in fact still are trying to build a new stadium and haven't succeeded yet for all sorts of reasons, not finance, but just political reasons within Rome. And funny enough, and again, this is something that's going to happen, I think, at Everton. In Rome, one of the big issues is who pays for all of the infrastructure and development work that needs to go into not just the stadium, but, you know, rail links, road links and everything else. And the Rome city authorities are saying to Roma, you have to pay for it. And Roma have been saying all along, well, yeah, we'll pay something, but actually, you know, at the end of the day, you're the people who are responsible for building infrastructure in the city, not us as a football club. And I suspect the same, you know, those same conversations, and we've talked about it, haven't we, in recent weeks, will now go on between Everton Football Club, Liverpool City Council, the regional authority run by Steve Rotherham, and an incoming Labour government. So Everton may find it easier than Friedkin has with Roma. But going back to your point, they definitely had those discussions with UEFA early on, and although for a number of years they've been under some form of regulatory control, so they've been limited in terms of what they can spend, but this was an agreed settlement with UEFA that Friedkin put in place. So there's no reason to suspect why, having done it once with Roma and UEFA, he hasn't got the gumption to go and do it again with the Premier League.
Right.
What the impact of that is, who knows?
Well, cool.
Or what, let's hope so. What the outcome of it is, not impact.
Yeah.
What were the other questions that you got, Paul?
Okay, so first of all, who is this guy? Right, so he's an American, which I think...
He produced Martin Scorsese's last film, Flowers of the Killer Moon. And I don't know, because I can't be asked Googling it, but the name Friedkin goes right through American Hollywood history. Friedkin directed and produced The Exorcist.
Yeah, although I think they're distantly related.
Right. They've obviously got their fingers in that pie anyway.
Yeah, very much so, because I looked it up. So The Square, which I don't know, All the Money in the World, The Mule, and Killers of the Flower Moon. And the last one he directed was The Last Vermeer. Don't know if they mean anything to you.
No.
And he also took a... He's a licensed pilot.
That's right.
Yeah, he also worked...
Him flying the Spitfire
in Dunkirk.
In Dunkirk, yeah.
Yeah.
Because his personal Spitfire is in better condition than the ones the RAF have got.
was that right?
Yeah. I mean, this guy must have looked at the situation that we were just discussing and gone, right, this is a 3-year job to stabilize this to even start with. So he will not, I'm imagining, I mean, I'm putting words in his mouth, but I mean, as a fan, all I'm bothered about is, do we have to lose Onana and Pickford and DCL and Branthwaite to balance the books from the last bollocks? And I suspect his answer will be, yeah, don't worry about it. I'm going to balance the books. And in 2 or 3 years' time, there will be another Branthwaite along and we'll find him. And, you know, he's got to sort out the whole business, hasn't he? You know, as fans, we think very short term. Don't sell him and don't sell him to United and all that sort of behaviour. But he must have much... He must have a very... Because of the timing that he's taken over, he must have taken into account exactly what you were just talking about, Andy, that, you know, the transfer window is open. And of course, the Premier League are not going to go, oh, we'll let you off because it was our bollocks that got us.
No, I'm not suggesting they should let us off. I just think there's a case for, say, for a new owner saying, hang on a minute, you know, none of this length of time is the fault of the club. It's been the fault of the previous owner. And so we're asking for an accommodation with regards to whatever, you know, because if we have to sell, if there is no accommodation and if we are falling foul of profit and sustainability rules again, and we have to sell in order to make those payments or balance the books or whatever, and we have to lose or we end up losing, you know, Pickford, Branthwaite, Onana, whether he wants to stay or go is immaterial, and possibly another, then that's just, I'm trying to think of the right words to use. You know, we're already behind an eight ball. If we then have to sell 3 or 4 players, I mean, all we're doing is we're hamstringing ourselves.
And
the rest of the Premier League, or the, you know, Richard Masters or whoever, are turning a blind eye to the fact that one of their constituent clubs is falling by the wayside. Is that a good advert for the Premier League that they just stand by and allow it to happen?
I understand what you're saying, Andy, but I'm not buying the argument one little bit. If I'm just going to put my Premier League hat on, I'm going to go, sorry, that's your business. You bollocked it up, sort it out. Your man who was in charge is an idiot. It's not my fault. Don't come to me going, look, but he was an idiot. Now he's gone now. Can we please have our ball back? No, it's not going to happen. No, and I suspect Friedkin knows that. And he's budgeted for that. And he's thinking about, you know, he's got to look further ahead than we as fans would want to or have to.
Okay.
I think it's just how I feel about it. I mean, I hope I'm wrong. And it'd be lovely if you were right, but I can't see that happening myself, Andy.
All right, fair enough. We'll agree to disagree.
And I'll buy the pies when you're right, and I'm wrong.
Yeah.
I think, in a sense, I sort of agree with you both. I think, Andy, you're right that we should be presenting that case, but I think the outcome is more closely aligned with George's view of these things. But I think the one thing that we've got to realize here, and this is, you know, I did a little smiley face on Twitter, which annoyed an awful lot of people on Friday morning.
You seem to annoy an awful lot of people without even trying, pal.
Well, yeah, I can promise you it's not deliberate. And I put a little smiley face because one, I knew that the Friedkin thing was going to happen, and two, I'd promised that I wouldn't say anything. But The smiley face was there because, first of all, it's a conclusion to Mashiri's time at the club. Secondly,
smiley face.
Yeah. Secondly, it was a conclusion to this particular transaction, or at least it was a way forward from the impasse that we got to. You know, during the week, as I said, it was a crazy, crazy week. During the week, we had Kenneth King, who runs this company, ACAP, that is likely to lose around three, possibly will lose around about $3 billion from the demise of 777, in London, trying to buy Everton Football Club. You know, an insurance company trying to buy Everton Football Club. Thankfully, he got nowhere with it. But that, you know, that's the type of stuff that even this week, you know, the madness, that's the type of madness that we were, and the word that I heard more frequently this week, apart from swear words, was dysfunctional. So if I picked up the phone to somebody and asked them, how is it? It was dysfunctional. Everything about the week was dysfunctional. The one thing I can guarantee about these guys is that they're highly professional, and that they are first and foremost business people. And for how many years have we talked about getting business people into the football club to run this like a proper business? These guys will do that. And if you look at what they've done at Roma, they've done exactly what needs to be done at Everton. They
great stuff. Good to hear.
Immediately got rid of the old board. They put a new board in. They sorted out the finances. First and foremost, they wanted at Roma, and they did this. And they wanted to create a platform from which there was stability, and that would then allow them to go forward. Now, they rolled the dice a bit, because if you remember, that Jose Mourinho turned up there as manager, and that didn't exactly work out to plan. I suspect that they won't do the same at Everton, in the sense of rolling the dice, because once they realised that the Mourinho thing wasn't working, or wasn't working in the way that they wanted it to work, you know, they scaled back. And if you look at the amount of money that they've spent and everything else, on the face of it, there will be a number of Evertonians going, well, they haven't spent much money, have they? And you know, if you go on to the various English websites, which there seems to be a lot in relation to Roma Football Club, you'll find lots of fans moaning about the fact that, you know, they're not spending huge sums of money. But you then have to look at their performance on the pitch, and the performance on the pitch, you know, we would chop our right arms off for. Qualifying for Europe, okay, they didn't qualify for the Champions League last season, but qualifying for Europe, winning the Europa League, which was one of their objectives. And they will bring a huge increase in the level of professionalism to Everton Football Club, and that will be bringing new people in, bringing new executives in, and sorting the finances out. Doing pretty much what they did at Rome, which was getting hold of the existing debt. People, lots of the questions that were asked on Twitter was, you know, what are we going to do about our existing debt? How much debt are we going to have under the new ownership? How much equity, which is the money that they put into the club, will there be? There's going to be debt at Everton for quite a considerable period of time going forwards. The question is, how much debt, and at what price is that debt? What price does that debt cost us? Because it will be debt more similar to what you might consider to be a mortgage, like Arsenal and Tottenham have on their stadium, putting it in very simple terms. It will be much lower cost than our current debt, which is more like a credit card debt in the sense that it's short term. So we will save an awful lot of money on that. We'll also, the amount of debt that we actually carry will be significantly reduced. So, as everybody knows, at the moment, we're carrying around about 580 million of external debt, and we've got Mashiri's 450 million. Mashiri's 450 million is going to disappear. He's not going to get paid it, and Everton will have no liability to pay it going forward. So it'll just be wiped clean. It will go, and Mashiri's lost the money, and that's it. The 580 million, some of that will be paid off with cash that the Freakins provide, just as they did with Roma. And the rest of it will be swapped from short-term expensive debt to much longer-term, less expensive debt. And that will be set against the stadium. So we will end up with probably around about £350 million of debt that's set against the stadium, but that will be at a much lower interest rate than what we're currently paying. And the rest of the money that the club needs will be provided as equity. So it will be put into the club. It's not a loan. It's put into the club and it will be spent, obviously, but it stays in the club. It can't be pulled back by the new shareholders. And that's precisely what they did at Roma. So if you look at, people say they haven't spent much money at Roma. If you look at what they've spent at Roma since 2020, they've spent very nearly one billion, so 1,000 million euros. That includes the cost of buying Roma in the first place, but that's what they've spent. And they're probably going to have to spend a very similar amount at Everton.
Yeah.
You know, the people I was involved with in terms of what were we looking at, had we been able to buy Everton, a similar figure, 750, 800 million pounds at an absolute minimum. That's how much it costs to buy Everton Football Club, pay off the debt, provide the money that's needed for the stadium, provide the money that's needed for the football club. Only a very small amount of that goes back to Farhad Moshiri. And I think, I don't know the figures because obviously I'm not privy to what Freakins agreed, and it's not in the media, and it may never be in the media. But I think the maximum Moshiri will get out of this is £50 million. For
right.
Everything that he's put into the club. And believe me, that's considerably more than what anybody else was offering, apart from 777. But, you know, we can discount them because they never had a chance. As I said, from day one, they never had a chance of acquiring the football club. So all the current debt will go, including the debt to 777. And it will be replaced by permanent money, which is called equity, and a long-term loan, which is secured against the stadium. So Everton will be back on a stable footing. The other thing that they've done at Roma, which is, and again, several of the questions, I'm not answering each individual question. I'm just covering the topics that those questions are asked. So if people asked questions, they will understand where their question comes in. The other thing that they've done at Roma, and they've done quite successfully, is increase commercial revenues. So these are commercial guys, you know, they make, predominantly they've made the money a little bit in the film industry, as you say, George, but predominantly through owning they sell cars. So I think they're Toyota's largest single seller of cars outside of Japan. So they own, what's the word, Andy? Sorry, my brain's gone dead.
Franchise dealerships.
Yeah, they own franchise dealerships in numerous states across the US. And I had a quick look before, they sold $8 billion worth of cars last year.
Wow.
So that's where they make their money from. So these are just good business people who know how to run a business and know how to run a business profitably. And they will bring those disciplines, which is what we've asked for years, certainly what I've asked for years, into the football club. And they'll set new standards of professionalism within the club, which is what we want. Doesn't mean that we'll necessarily have huge sums of money to spend on players initially, but they'll generate more revenue through their professionalism because they'll have a better idea of how to go about getting commercial revenues into the club. The other really interesting thing is, and this is quite unique in Italian football. So the stadium, they use the old Olympic Stadium in Rome, and they share it currently
with Lazio.
With Lazio, neither of which really like the fact that they have to share the stadium with their rivals. But I was reading a statistic that said, for the last 57 home games, they've sold out every single game.
Brilliant.
And in Italy, that is an enormous achievement.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done it because they engage properly with the fan base. They give the fans what the fans want, not necessarily what they want necessarily, or all the time on the pitch. But they've built this relationship with the fan base. And it was difficult for them to begin with, because the Roma fans already had a bad experience of previous American owners in this guy, Pelota, who, really messed things up. And if one thing that they probably didn't quite appreciate when they first came into Roma was that they probably should have had some locals involved in the club from a very early stage to form a bridge between what they were trying to achieve, what the fans expected. And also, Italy politics plays a big part, both locally and nationally, in most affairs in Italy. They found it very difficult politically to get accepted, partly because of the previous owners, but also because they didn't necessarily have that local representation. And whilst Andy Bell and George Downing, their bid has failed, and I don't see them having a formal position going forwards, because I just don't think it's in their nature to do that, having failed. I hope...
Would they get their money back, Paul?
Yeah, part of these loans, part of the money that's about to be paid back to Everton will go straight to MSP, and will also include George Downing and Andy Bell. So they will be squared off. And from their perspective, that's obviously, they would have loved to have acquired the club, but, they're getting this next best thing, which is they're going to get their money back. As I say, I don't think, and some people have asked the question, do you think Andy and George, the other Andy and George, will be...
Can we get our money back?
Well, if you let me know how much you put in, George, I'll ask.
40 million.
All right, I shall ask tomorrow on your behalf. I just hope that they do engage with local people. Obviously, they'll engage with the fan base, and they will engage with the FAB, the fan advisory board and stuff like that going forward. But also, there are some influential Evertonians in and around the city of Liverpool, as proven by Andy and George and others as well. And it would do them no harm at all if they took the lessons that they learned at Roma and applied them very early on in the process at Everton. Lots of people asked, how do I feel about it? Am I pleased about it? And I'm very encouraged by it. I think, obviously, I would have really liked Andy and George to get the deal, and the other people that were involved at MSD are good people, and they know football really well. But I think these people coming in, the Friedkin group, are going to be very good for us. And it gives us what we've all been crying out for: stability and professionalism and people who know how to run a business properly. And from that, then hopefully we can recreate a football team that reflects who Everton actually are, not the chaos that descended upon the club under Moscheri's
guidance. It's a complete... It's not just the team, though, is it? It's the club as well.
It's everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is absolutely everything.
The public image of the club has been damaged. And, as I said before, there's huge repair work to be done. So, as you said, if these guys are professional and businessmen, they'll hopefully go about it in the right way and in a sensible time scale as well. Obviously fans want things to happen overnight. That ain't going to happen overnight. But if they come, when they put their plans together and appoint people and bring in new new people. Hopefully they'll all be on the same page and have some real structure about the way they go about rebuilding and repairing the situation that they're about to inherit.
Yeah, absolutely,
Andy. And they will make decisions that sometimes I think fans might not appreciate in the first instance, but they know, like, I'm not picking myself up here in any sense or comparing me to them. Like I've always said, you've got to run the business properly in order to be a success. What happens off the pitch impacts what's on the pitch. Yeah. And for so long, Mishiri never recognised that. And that's why we, you know, and thank goodness that we survived the situations that we found ourselves in. A lot of which is down to the fans as well, in terms of our survival. And that should, you know, as we come out of this awful period from under Mishiri, that should never be lost and never be forgotten, the role of the fans in all of this.
You would imagine, actually, that while the Friedkin people have been considering or having an interest in acquiring Everton Football Club, that they've noticed, or they'll have been advised and informed of what kind of animal the Everton fan base is, in as much as we've been through 3 years of utter crap on the pitch, off the pitch. And the fan base has pulled together like nobody could have imagined and even and thought was possible. And they must be thinking, crikey, look at these guys. They sell out every game. You know, they go to ridiculous lengths to get behind the players who have been struggling at times and what have you. You know, imagine what we could do if we could turn this into a success. Just imagine the kind of fervour that...
I bet that's part of why they've made such a big bid and seemingly got the gig, Andy. You know, there is a new stadium. There's only one more year in, and they must have respect for the fan base.
Yeah.
Everything that you're saying and everything that Paul's saying, it's really nice to sit and listen to us three being positive about our club.
Yeah, absolutely. Funny enough, and I will name him, a guy called David Murphy asked, can you give three advantages, three disadvantages, three hopes and three fears for this takeover? And I think we've already given the advantages and we've already given the hopes. I think, to be fair, just to balance it out, there are one or two things that we have to consider. One is the fact that already owning Roma, we are effectively entering a multi-club operation. So where do we sit relative to Roma? Are we equal to Roma? Are we less than Roma? Are we greater than Roma in terms of, you know, their management resources and everything else? Where do their priorities lie? I think it's too early to know the answer to that, but I think it's something that, and I hope that either the Friedkins or the Friedkins advisors are listening, it's something that they have to answer, and they have to answer it not only for us, but they also have to answer it for the Roma fans, because
for Roma, yeah,
we're not wanting to compete with Roma. We just want a successful football club, as
well.
We
not
said.
Till we get into Europe.
Well, then, that is, you know, then that becomes the next issue. That if in 3 or 4 years' time we end up competing in the same European competitions, what happens then? Now, there is some precedent in terms of. Well, is it? Strictly speaking, it's against UEFA's rules for two clubs to enter the same competition that are commonly owned. But there are some examples where that's happening. So Manchester City and Girona in Spain. And you know, what happens with Manchester United and Nice with regards to Ineos. So I think whilst it's a potential issue, and it's not going to become an issue for some years, I don't think, unless Everton, you know, perform unexpected miracles. But that is an issue that needs to be resolved. And I think UEFA are going to find it very difficult to stick to their initial principles of not allowing, you know, two clubs commonly owned to be in the same competition. I think they have to just accept that whatever happens, the football's played in good faith, and you know, there's true competition between the clubs, because that's how it should be. Just the fact that we've got the same owners. If we were to draw against Roma in whatever competition, then we would want to beat Roma as much as Roma would want to beat us. So why would that necessarily be an issue?
By the time we get into Europe, the UEFA will have caught up with the fact that multi-club models is a part of the future.
I suspect you're right, George. I think you are. But you know, just trying to provide some balance, that is currently an unresolved issue, but not really a particularly relevant issue. What other possible disadvantages are there? I really can't think of any, to be honest. Any other than the fact that even with the best laid plans, nothing in life is ever guaranteed. But then that would be true of anybody that's coming in.
Yep.
So it's not a real disadvantage. It's something you just have to be aware of. When new people take over a business, they do so with the best of intents, and it doesn't always work out the way that they want. But on the evidence so far of how they run their own businesses and how they've run Roma, I think we should be fairly confident. And certainly if we just want to take where we currently are as the sort of, you know, the bottom line, we're going to be so far ahead of where we are currently that, you know, almost everything will be beneficial. So I'm reasonably confident on that. As I say, I don't think there's going to be a huge change to our plans over the summer. I do think that whereas had the takeover not happened, we might have lost three out of the four players that we've mentioned earlier. I suspect that probably now becomes two out of the four players. So I think the prospects of losing Pickford and the prospects of losing DCL have reduced quite significantly as a result of this takeover, because one would hope that they could see that there's going to be greater stability in the club going forwards. So I think that's a big positive. It doesn't do anything necessarily about Onana, it doesn't do anything necessarily about Brathwaite, but I think it would do with the other two. And I think also, if we're looking for more positives, regardless of what budgets we've got by the end of the transfer window, surely to goodness, players who might never have considered coming to Everton because of the chaos surrounding Fahad Moshiri might recognise that actually that chaos is now behind us, and this is once more a professionally run football club organisation. And, you know, I don't think we're going to change manager, and I don't think we're going to change director of football, at least not in the first instance. I think Dyche has probably earned, you know, time for next season. I can't believe for a second that they would want to change Dyche in the first instance. And I know a few people have messaged me and said, aren't we now going to get a better manager, and aren't we going to see more attractive football at Goodison in the last year at Goodison? We might see more attractive football, but I think it'll be under the same manager. And I think, to be fair to Dyche, I think he deserves it.
Can't disagree with that.
No.
That might not be necessarily what everybody wants to hear, but, you know, that's just...
The business of saying what everybody wants to hear is...
We'd all like to see more attractive football. We'd all like to see winning football. I think the biggest thing that the new ownership can do is change the mindset within the club, at all levels within the club, off the field, on the field, that we are no longer going to be also runs, feeders for other clubs. You know, we are, you know, the aim is to return Everton to the top table. It may take longer than any of us would want it to, but changing the mindset, you know, the immediate, we go a goal behind and, oh God, blimey, we're in another struggle. You know, it's just a case of, you know, all right, we fell behind. We've just got to go out and score two. Change the mindset. Get people thinking positively about Everton Football Club at all levels, on and off the pitch. That would go an enormous way to repairing the wrongs of the past.
I bet the people who are in their jobs at the moment, Andy, who are actually running Everton Football Club, because it's not, you know, it's not Bashir and it's not the board anymore. I'm sure they'll be, you know, thinking, I hope I keep my job, but they must also be thinking, oh, thank Christ for this. Thank Christ for a breath of fresh air through the place and sweep out what has been, to my taste, negativity and corruption for a very long time.
That's what I said, change the mindset.
Yeah. No, I agree with you, darling.
Yeah,
because you were arguing with me before.
I know, and I'm your elder brother. I shouldn't be doing that. I should be bringing you on.
Oh.
All right, just running through any. I thought I saw a couple of questions I haven't answered yet. Maybe you need to talk amongst yourselves while I just like run through all these questions.
I'm sure. As we speak, then Denmark are ahead against Slovenia, but that proves it's live.
just waiting for the big one later. I know what I wanted to talk about.
Go on. And,
some good news, I think. We've changed shirt manufacturers.
Yes.
So we're now
Castore.
Yeah. And the club, I haven't looked, to be honest, what the club have claimed, but I know certainly the Telegraph claimed that it was a doubling of the previous deal.
With Hummel.
And if that is the case, that's very good news. And what they were leveraging off was the fact that we're moving into the new stadium. But I think there's a little bit of spin here, because I think that whilst it's gone from 10 to 20 million, they're going to be doing other things as well. So I think the Castore name will appear on much more of Everton's sort of, you know, advertising and marketing, and maybe around the stadium. I'm not saying stadium naming rights, but right. You know, the branding around the stadium. If you remember when USM got involved, obviously they did Finch Farm, but then like Megafon came in, and there was a sort of almost like blanket coverage of Megafon around Goodison Park, if you recall. You know, all the digital advertising hoardings and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that's what this deal, the Castore deal, which is very, very welcome, the fact that it's gone from 10 to 20 million. And congratulations to those that did this. But I think I think we're not comparing like with like. So to say that it's doubled, you know, there's an awful lot more to this than just the shirts themselves. What it hasn't changed is, of course, the relationship with Kickback, as it used to be, Fanatics. And still, we're going to have the issue that, you know, if you're in Ireland or if you're in most of the US states, it will be impossible to buy a shirt. It'd be impossible to walk into a store and buy a shirt. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that an incoming
that needs to be addressed.
Owner needs to address. They need to address the relationship between Castore, Everton Football Club, and retailers, and move away from this model that they've got with fanatics, because it doesn't work. And I'm sure, like lots of people who do podcasts and things, I get loads of people saying, is there anything you can do about this? And frankly, there isn't. You know, it's what the club have got themselves signed up for, and that needs to change. And hopefully now under new ownership, and as I say, given the evidence that what happened has happened in Roma, these guys know a little bit more about retailing and about distribution and about selling products. You know, given that they sell Toyota, they know how to sell a product. So I'm hoping it's going to change.
Good.
Good.
And I think on that rare positive note, we are
run for the hills, quick.
I think we're done.
Right.
Before we speak next, I think the fixtures come out this week on the 18th.
I've no idea, Paul, to be honest.
Okay. Well, if they don't, I apologise, but everybody will be waking up on the 18th and saying, yes, said. I think they come out on the 18th.
Right.
Or is it the 18th? Oh. It can't be the 18th of July, that would be too late.
The 18th of July would be too late, yeah.
The fixtures may be out this week.
Right. Well, we'll see who we open up against then.
Yeah. All right. Let's. No, I'm not going to say anything else. There you go. A podcast mixed with a huge amount of sadness because of Kevin Campbell. And, you know, any levity in the podcast as a result of what's happening off the pitch has to be balanced.
Kevin Campbell would have appreciated.
He would have done. He would have. He you know, I said that his, you know, his soul will be in peace, and whether you're religious or not, wherever he is, he will be looking down and smiling on Everton and hoping that those smiles turn into good fortune for us.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, gents, and thank you to everybody for listening. Thank you for all the questions. I think I've got through everyone. If anybody feels that their question hasn't been answered, just drop me a line, and I'll either answer it personally to you.
Right to the right. Just contact the podcasting ombudsman.
Yeah. It's George Costigan at
Father's Day. Father's Day Magnum section.
Oh yeah, that is one question.
Come on.
What is your favourite Magnum?
Mine?
Yeah.
I haven't tried yet, and everybody says they're brilliant, because the vegan ones. So I'm going to hold fire until I can buy myself a vegan Magnum. At the moment, the salted caramel has pole position.
Oh, no.
No?
No.
Don't say double chocolate, Andy.
No. I prefer the white one.
I think Andy's chocolate man.
The thin brown chocolate and the white one, the minty one.
Yeah.
It's a bit good, that. There's no such thing as a disappointing Magnum, is there?
No, but I think I'm not overly struck on the salted caramel one, personally.
I'll have them, then.
You have them, yeah.
When this podcast is finished, because I can't possibly tell you the story, I'll tell you a story about disappointing Magnums.
Oh, okay.
It's got Clint Eastwood in it.
Not Magnum Force.
Yeah.
No, the ice cream. Okay. On that note, because I know now you're going to be on tenderhooks waiting for the story, and I'm sorry for everybody else for not hearing it, but there you go. It's just the way the cookie crumbles. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
We'll get on to crumbling cookies next week.
Well, we've done ice creams this week, we may as well. Thank you, everybody. Disappointing news. More than disappointing news, sorry. But some good news as well, some great news about the club going forward, and that's what we've got to look to. So thank you, everybody. Thank you, George, Andy. And we'll speak to you all soon.
Cheers.
Cheers, mate.